This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, we're going to tell stories today.
Storytelling time.
You know, there's three or four kinds of people that get what used to be referred to as guilty knowledge. In other words, you get to go places where not everybody gets to go.
Okay.
Priests, cops, nurses, and sometimes journalists.
Okay.
By their prying nature, go to places that are sometimes private and outside of often public view. And you often get to see people in very human moments that the rest of us get glimpses of only rarely. The Arizona Republic has been running a series of reporter stories of some of the more interesting things that got maybe the official side got reported, but the human side not always. And I've been reading those for the last week or so. And two of the best anecdotes that I saw written up were by Bob Ortega and Daniel Gonzalez, both of whom are our guests here today. Daniel, you and Bob and others have been doing a whole series of things related to immigration, Mexican, Central American, and tell us some of the more impactful things that you've observed on the human level.
Well, last year, Bob and I went down to cover this surge of migrant children that were coming from Central America and coming across the border in South Texas. And Bob went down to Central America, and I went down to the border of South Texas in Reynosa, Mexico. And first of all, I mean, it was a pretty scary place to visit. We had a lot of discussions beforehand whether we even thought it was safe enough to go there. I don't know if you're familiar with Reynosa, but it's considered probably the most dangerous city in Mexico. Juarez, across the border from El Paso, gets a lot of the attention.
Drugs, gangs.
Drug cartels. There's a couple of drug cartels that are fighting for territory, the Juarez cartel.
Well, that's
cartel
when it gets real nasty. Not just having the cartel, but if it's a competitive area.
Exactly. And there's also another carteler called the Zetas, and they're battling for control. And they have a lot of control over the police and the government there. So there's not a lot of security. So there was concerns about safety. And I remember kind of one anecdote is before we went, I went with photographer David Wallace, a fantastic photographer. We spent one day on the U.S. side, and then the next day we were getting ready to cross over into Reynosa. And we had seen a lot of the photographs before we went, some really grisly scenes of bodies hanging from bridges and decapitated people and that kind of thing. And so really, really didn't know what to expect when we crossed over. And I remember we sat in the car before we drove over, and we kind of took a deep breath. And I remember David turning to me and saying, okay, let's do this. And we crossed over in the border. And the interesting thing is, this is a major crossing. These two cities, McAllen, Texas, and Reynosa, Mexico, is well over a million people metropolis. But there was hardly any people driving into Mexico. The lanes were almost completely empty.
Don't paint over that. Tell us what you were feeling when he said, okay, let's do this. That moment right there, what's going through your mind?
Honestly, I was scared. I mean, yeah. I was very anxious. I remember thinking, you know, what's going to happen? Are we going to make it out of there alive? I remember thinking about my family and just kind of hoping for the best. We were going to meet somebody on the other side. And really, we were putting our complete trust in this person who we had never met before. I had just talked to him on the phone. He's a journalist, pretty well known in Reynosa. He's helped. We call him fixers in journalism, and he works as a fixer for a lot of news organizations in the United States. But the interesting thing is, over the last couple of years, most, if not all, the journalists in Texas had actually stopped going into Reynosa because it was considered just too dangerous. So when we were sitting in that car, it was a scary moment. We were anxious and really didn't know what to expect, and we didn't know what we would encounter. And the funny thing is, when we crossed over, it seemed almost anticlimactic. It was a city like any other city, border city in Mexico. The people were walking around in the streets, and there was a lot of traffic and a lot of hustle and bustle. And I remember kind of thinking, this doesn't really seem so bad. The one thing that was disconcerting is there were a lot of very heavily armed soldiers right at that border crossing, right when we got across the border.
Probably had mixed feelings about that, too.
Yeah, so it's disconcerting to see these guys, so young-looking guys with very large weapons standing there at the border. But the kind of weird thing that happened is when we crossed over, we couldn't find the guy that we were looking for.
Oh, boy.
And we parked our car, and I was on the cell phone with him. And we had, before we crossed over, I had made sure that we could make sure that we could get a hold of him on the cell phone. We had some trouble beforehand. We tested it out, so we knew we'd be able to get a hold of him. I get over, and the guy's not there. The place where he was supposed to meet us, he wasn't there. And, of course, you start panicking and getting a little paranoid and wondering, you know, is this kind of some kind of setup, or, you know, is he working with the cartels? All kinds of paranoid thoughts start running through your head.
Human thoughts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so he, I got a hold of him on the phone, and he was like, you know, just park your car and I'll find you. And eventually, within a few minutes, we found him, and he was a super gregarious guy, real friendly. He gets in the car, and that really helped put us at ease. He gets in the car. He goes, you know what? I'm going to drive because you guys don't know your way around. And so he gets behind the wheel, and I'm in the passenger seat, and David's in the back seat. And right away, he starts giving us some ground rules. He said, hey, don't take your camera out. We're not going to let anybody know that you're a journalist, because the cartel people, if they see people photographing them, they might think that you're working with the police. So you're going to be really, really careful with what you do with your camera. Don't stick it out the window. To only take pictures when I say it's going to be okay. We were on our way to drive to a shelter to go interview some kids. And then within minutes, we're driving, really literally within minutes, a police car, municipal police car, they call it Transito Police, pulls up next to us and kind of rides alongside us for a few moments and then pulls ahead. I didn't think anything of it. And then he said, that police car is sent here by the cartels to do surveillance on you. They know you're here.
Man.
They're kind of putting the word out, hey, these guys have arrived. And the other thing that was kind of interesting is before we left, we had asked him, are we going to be safe there? We were paying him money, you know, to get us to the places that we need to go. And he said, the money that you're paying me, I hope it's okay to say, but he was saying, the money that you're paying me, it's paying for my services, but also to make sure that these people don't, you know, bother you while you're here. So
Was it much?
It was like $250 a day, so not a lot.
Not at all.
No.
For private guide and darn near security.
As protection money goes, yeah. that's a bargain basement
right.
stuff, I guess.
Look, I want to finish the story up after a break. We're talking about the human side, the behind-the-scenes stories of Arizona's biggest stories of the last year right here on The Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are here talking behind-the-scenes stories with Bob Ortega and Daniel Gonzalez, ace reporters, Arizona Republic. Okay, you've taken us. You've crossed the border into Reynosa, Mexico. You got escorted by the police/cartel into a immigration center with children. Pick up the story where you left off.
Well, so after that, we went into this shelter, and it was a shelter that was actually right on the border of Reynosa. It was right on the Rio Grande, and you could actually see the United States from this shelter. It was so close by. And we went in, and it was a shelter that was run by a Christian pastor. It was a pretty nice complex. They had a kind of a chapel, and they had a basketball court, and they had dormitories that separated the men from the women.
And are they all kids here, or are they?
There was a mixture of children, men, and women, and these are all people who were trying to get into the United States.
Mexican, Central Americans, or both?
All of the above. There was a lot of Central Americans were there, and then there were also some Mexicans, and these were people who had somehow gotten thwarted in their attempt, and they needed some place to live. They had no money left over, and they were trying to make it into the United States. And this pastor was providing them with shelter. Some of these folks were given up. They were trying to get back home. They had nowhere to go, and they were going to try to get back to wherever they came from. But there was a lot of kids living there, and a lot of women with children. Some of these children were very, very young, as infant children, the people who had come all the way from Central America. So
the kids, some of them alone? without parents?
Yes. We spent most of the morning. We got there maybe around 8:30 in the morning. We spent several hours focusing on this one boy. He was 14 years old. I remember him very, very well. He was a real cute-looking kid, a really charming boy. And he had traveled completely on his own from Honduras. Some of these kids get help from smugglers. Their parents leverage, you know, their houses and get money from relatives in the United States. This kid had left home with like $11 in his pocket and made it all the way from Honduras to the border of Mexico. He had run out of money and he had been living in the shelter now for over a month trying to figure out what he was going to do. The smugglers charge you about $100 to make that trip across the river. Completely controlled by criminal organizations. You can't get across that river unless
you can't swim it alone.
No. You risk being killed if you attempt that on your own. Mm-hmm. Completely controlled by criminal organizations. So he was trying to raise the money to get across the border. We spent quite a bit of time. He had quite a harrowing story of how he got there and that basically living, begging on the streets and going up to food carts and telling them, hey, I'm a kid from Honduras. Can you help me out with some food? And working where he could and getting shaken down by Mexican authorities on the way and having police officers in this country, if they came across a child who was by themselves, they would help him. And he told us stories about in Mexico how he was, they robbed him, that the police actually took what money he had left and kind of left him to fend for himself. So it was a pretty heartbreaking stories from some of these kids. There was another woman that we met, I remember, who was traveling with a little girl who had Down syndrome and had traveled also all the way from, I think she was from El Salvador, trying to reach the United States.
Wow. So Honduras, how did these kids get, would they come up on these trains that we've seen the pictures of the trains?
Yeah, so some of them would come up on trains. There's a couple of different routes that they take. So there's a train known as La Bestia, which is actually a whole series of different routes that feed up.
In English, the beast.
The beast, yeah, mm-hmm. that runs along the Gulf Coast, essentially, and goes up into Texas. That's mm-hmm. why they were all going to the Rio Grande Valley, because that's the shortest and most direct route from Central America.
Uh-huh.
Now, some of the families that have more money were also putting their kids on buses. They would have these different routes that would go on the roads. But you have to pay much more to do that.
So what would it cost? Cheapest bus?
Well, I mean, like you said, some of these kids were sitting out on the train for $11. If you're talking on the buses, you're probably paying several thousand dollars, because it isn't just a question of going across and getting on a bus. You're paying these coyotes, these smugglers, to essentially guarantee mm-hmm. that you're going to be able to make your way safely all the way to the border.
And that's a very loose guarantee, by the way, right?
Yeah, well, of course.
Yeah.
And so in many cases, what they're paying for is the opportunity to try a certain number of times, usually three times.
Okay.
And if you fail three times, then you're out of luck. But that's mm-hmm. the arrangement. I mean, it's like anything. The more money you pay, the easier the travel becomes.
And to put this in scale, my understanding of wages in Mexico is about $1 an hour for labor in the south, maybe $2 in the north. I'm guessing Central America is probably below the lower figure.
It's lower, yeah. Mm-hmm. The economy in Honduras and the economy in El Salvador is very weak, and there's a huge number of people that basically live a subsistence lifestyle, you know, where they make very, very little money. There's a lot of people in agricultural areas that they've been devastated by diseases that have struck the coffee crops there. And so there are a lot of other economic problems and social problems that are pushing people out. One of the things that we found in talking to these kids was that some of them were, in fact, coming primarily because they wanted to look for work, or they wanted to rejoin a mother or other family member who's already here. But in the majority of cases, they were fleeing violence. They were fleeing specific direct threats from gangs. They were fleeing because they'd had friends who'd been killed or family members who'd been killed. So they looked at the situation and thought, well, if I go on the road, and they knew it was going to be dangerous. If I go on the road, I might get killed. I might not make it. But if I stay here, I'm dead.
And that distinction is critical in terms of American law, is it not?
whether or not they are economic refugees or fleeing legitimate fear of persecution?
Yeah, that's the basis for an asylum claim, is a legitimate fear of persecution. Mm-hmm.
And if you have a legitimate fear of persecution, you can get asylum. You can get a legal status here.
Yes, but you have to show it's actually much more complicated than that, because not only you can't just come here and show you're fleeing poverty or you're being persecuted, you actually have to prove that you're being persecuted for a specific reason, for your political views, for example.
Not just that I'm living in a neighborhood where everybody's getting shot up, but if the cartel's after me personally because I was suspected to be an informant and I could prove it, then that passes.
How can you prove it, though? What do you show them, emails that you were threatened by? I mean, honestly.
That's part of the problem. And so, for example, one of the girls that we reported on, who was 18, traveled with her brother. And when they came across, because he was a minor, he was allowed to stay. She was sent back immediately because at 18, she's now, you know, no longer a minor. Mm-hmm. And she had expressed a fear. She had told the people who interviewed her with Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the Border Patrol that the reason they had fled was because a gang in her neighborhood had threatened to rape her. And in fact, when she was sent back, she was raped by that gang that had threatened
again,
to do so.
Again, the problem Mike raised, how do you prove it?
Yeah, and I want to stay on that. I want to get back to that. What we're doing is talking about the human side, the backstory, really the background, what you did not see in one of Arizona's biggest stories with this mass flood of immigrants coming across the border in Texas and in Arizona. We're going to get to more next on The Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We want to change the story to some more domestic observations, but we left hanging the issue of proof. And in the break, Bob, you had an observation about proof and how a potential immigrant goes about establishing that they, in fact, have legitimate, provable, I guess, evidence that they are being personally persecuted.
Well, it's very difficult, as Daniel said a little bit earlier. But what we have seen statistically is that those people applying for asylum who are represented by attorneys have an extremely high chance of getting asylum. And those who are not represented by attorneys are much, much less likely to be granted asylum. And we've seen cases of kids that are 3 years old up before an immigration judge with no attorney. Now imagine that situation.
What percentage get attorneys?
The most recent, now it's higher now than it was last year when the big surge was happening. Uh-huh. When the surge was happening, Daniel, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm thinking it was less than 10% initially.
Okay, so vast majority no attorneys.
The vast majority were not having
attorneys. That suggests the vast majority are getting sent back. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay. You had your piece that was published in the paper has some really interesting observations that you made more domestically and inside one of our prisons.
Right. So there's a set of stories that I wrote a while back called The Price of Prisons that were basically looking at the situation in the prison system here in Arizona. And, you know, it's one of those areas where a lot of people, their eyes kind of glaze over when you start to talk about prison conditions.
Because these are bad guys, we don't care.
Yeah, they're all bad guys, we don't care about them, whatever happens to them, that's what they deserve, et cetera. The thing is, the point of these stories was really to kind of look at the fact that, you know, when you're sentenced to prison for something, whatever it may have been, and some of these are bad guys who did really, really bad things, and some of them are people who made mistakes and are kind of paying the price for that, but when you're sentenced, what you're sentenced to is a certain amount of time in detention. You're not sentenced to die from lack of medical care or sentenced to be in a situation where you're at the mercy of criminal gangs that operate within many of the prison yards and who can extort money from your family or beat you to death if you don't essentially provide what they're asking for. And so that series we were looking at, people who were being held in solitary confinement for extended periods of time, often because they had a mental illness that was going untreated, and because they were mentally ill.
Then they act out.
They act out, and then they're punished by being in solitary confinement, which would drive you crazy even if you're completely sane, because you have to understand in solitary confinement, we're talking about a tiny cell, most of them windowless. in which you are being held 23 hours a day. And in many of these facilities, you're only actually getting out 2 to 3 times a week. When you get out, you walk down the hallway to another windowless cell where you're allowed to walk around. Hmm. And these exercise cells have walls that are about 20 feet high. And then at the top, there's a fencing. And, you know, you can see a little square of sky above you. That's all you get to see. That's all you see of the outdoors for all the time that you're in there. And you have really no interaction with anybody except the guard who is putting the handcuffs on you when they're walking you back and forth or taking you to get your shower once a week. And so it's...
Once a week on the shower?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sometimes twice a week. It kind of depends.
Right.
But the point is you're getting very, very little actual interaction with anybody. And so... It tends to be one of the things that we've seen is that solitary confinement tends to be overused, particularly when it comes to mentally ill people, and that
probably because it's easier.
Somebody's
acting out, sure, and the easiest thing is throw him in a box, and he's not a problem to the institution anymore.
Right. And that's been the subject of a huge class action lawsuit that the state is going through right now over how it treats prisoners and whether it's holding people in solitary confinement longer than they should, and in many cases when they shouldn't be held there. So part of this is that when I first started looking at these issues, we'll get letters from prisoners saying, you know, this thing is wrong or that thing is wrong. Can you guys look at it? And of course, there's not much sympathy for that. But when you start talking to family members and you get the details of what's actually happening in many of these cases, they're absolutely horrifying. Dostoevsky very famously once said that you can judge the caliber of a society by the state of its prisons. Hmm. And ours do not speak very highly of us.
Well, interesting.
I've heard that stated as how we treat the least of us. And clearly prisons are clearly among them.
That's right.
The very poor, the imprisoned. Were you strictly in adult prisons or did you go to juvenile facilities as well?
No, I didn't really look at juvenile facilities for that story. There is an issue that I did talk to some people who have been held in juvenile facilities, mm-hmm. and often to juveniles who, because they were convicted as adults, even though they were, you know, say 15, 16, 14 right. years old, were put in with adults
facility. That not everybody understands. You can be tried as an adult based on some subjective criteria that was an adult crime or whatever, in which case I believe you're going to go to an adult facility.
Yeah, so it varies to some degree. It kind of depends. And so a lot of these kids do wind up in juvenile facilities, but the juvenile facilities in some cases are in with adult prisons, and so mm-hmm. the degree to which they're segregated varies, and the conditions are equally problematic. I mean, it's the same kinds of conditions and the same overuse of solitary confinement, the same lack of access to medical care, very little opportunity for school. For schooling, and so
access to medical care. Can you flesh that out with examples? I mean, what level are we talking about?
Oh, so I mean, we're talking about basically anything more than an aspirin, you're pretty much out of luck. And so, the allegations, and many of these are this isn't just, you know, of course, when you talk to inmates, you might suspect, well, you know, they're exaggerating the situation, or family members might be exaggerating the situation. But all of these cases that I talked about in my stories were very, very clearly documented, where the requests for care and the lack of care were very documented. So we're talking about cases where, for example, somebody had a tumor. There was one guy that had a tumor in his liver, and it was swollen. It was cancerous. It was swollen so large that he looked like he was pregnant. And, you know, he kept requesting care for months and months and months to be taken out so somebody could look at it. And he never got any treatment, and he wound up dying.
Is there a mechanism in a case like that? Somebody has to review or document a decision, or is it just strictly request and you can be ignored?
Well, it's documented, but the problem is that unless you happen to have very well connected people on the outside that are pushing very hard,
which most prisoners aren't going to have,
you're not likely to get to be able to work the system to be able to get the treatment that you need.
Now, it can't be just, obviously the prisoners don't like this. It can't be just the prisoners. I have a hard time believing that there's a prison doctor or a prison medical staff that's just okay with this. That's right. That's it. Is it the I would think that the prison staff is just as upset about this as probably the prisoners are and want change. Are both sides calling for change?
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you, some of my best sources were medical personnel working within the prisons. Hmm. And even some guards who were appalled by how inadequate the medical care and the mental health care across the system was and is and continues to be. And so in many of these cases, those were the people who were contacting me to say, did you know about this? Did you know about that? Have you heard about this? This is going on in this yard or in this particular prison. So, you know, it is... a lot of them are just as concerned.
What kind of reactions have you got? I can see letters to the editor. Why should we be, you know, giving medical care to them when there's people on the outside haven't done it?
We got about 30 seconds up against a break here.
Sure. Well, you know, yes, of course, we got lots of letters and lots of comments to the editors saying, you know, the hell with these guys. Who cares about them? Whatever happens, happens. Mm-hmm. But also lots of comments from people who've known someone who's been in prison, who've had a family member in prison saying, thank you for calling attention to this. People don't understand and they need to know what's going on.
Gentlemen, thank you. Thank you for doing the work that you're doing. Thank you for showing us the other side, really. We see the headlines right here in our own KTAR newsroom. We report on as much as hard facts as we can, and what we miss is the inside, what we miss is the background, what we miss is the personal aspect, and I appreciate you both doing what you're doing. I really do. Doc O'Neill and I back to tie a bow around this next.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
You know, I would say that was super eye-opening, but I think there's some part of us, those that read, those that look a little deeper than just a headline, I think we knew it. I think we knew it, we felt it.
Sure.
It was interesting to hear it actually play out, to hear the actual stories. And what an amazing story to kick it off with, talking about during the wave of immigrants coming up from Central America last year, to talk about what it was like for a reporter, someone to bring this story to us, to actually cross that border and really go dig into this.
And not just crossing the border anywhere, but crossing it in a place that is absolutely reputed to be high crime.
The cops don't go there. Well, and if they go there, they're on the payroll from the cartel.
Yeah, well, that was the other staggering thing. Yeah, it was known they were coming. Get escorted by a cop who's really working for the cartel. I mean, there's a basic assumption you make in this country that when you approach a cop here for help, you generally get help.
Exactly. You know? They're on your team.
They're on your team. They're not going to shake you down.
Sure.
They may be more or less helpful, but you know, you got good guys and bad guys, and fundamentally, they're the good guys here.
Yeah, we see the bad apples on TV recently. We're seeing a lot of bad cop stories.
Well,
unfortunately,
those are the exceptions.
We hope that the majority of people know that that's the exception. But could you imagine being in an area, being in an area that, by the way, is your home, it's where you were born and raised, where that is not the case. The exception is the cop that's actually trying to help.
And I'll tell you, even if you're a city where there is a lot of overreach by the police and very bad relationships, say, with minority communities, an individual minority person in one of those cities that has a problem knows that they can approach an individual police officer and get decent treatment.
Sure,
the problems come when you have situations that are seen as confrontational.
Right.
In fact, I had a colleague years ago. This was after the 68 riots in Baltimore, in Detroit, it happened to be, and did a major survey of the community. And you know what the number one complaint about the police was? And this was in a time of high hostility. They don't always come when you call. We want
now.
Police to come.
Yeah.
I mean, and you wouldn't have that as a complaint, even in a context where you had a lot of hostility and a lot of bad relationships. An individual citizen who's getting broken into or threatened still feels that fundamentally the police are on our side.
I'm going to go to the other side. I have to play the other side. It's my role. It's what I do here on the Think Tank. Why is this our problem? Why do we need to take everyone who doesn't want to be a part of where they were born and raised? Why do we need to take them on because they don't like it, or maybe they're fearful, or why do we need to take that on?
It's It's a fair question. By the way, the part I'd really contest is we're the only. If you look at the number of refugees, I mean, in the countries that look at Lebanon, look at. I mean, there's places that have very way higher proportions of their populations that have taken.
Okay.
Southern Europe gets sure. gets. I mean, we are not alone in this regard.
Mm-hmm.
Britain. I mean, it's a lot of countries that basically it's countries that are stable. That have decent economies, have people trying to get there from who are getting away from countries that are either violent or poor.
Yes.
And it is a worldwide phenomenon. We are not alone, not by a long stretch. And there are countries that have way higher proportions
and
than
I
we
get
do.
That, but still, okay. It's worse somewhere
else. Why do we get it
doesn't
from Mexico?
It
why do we get it from Mexico? Because it's next door.
Well, exactly.
You know,
okay.
If they were next door to France, they would be going from Mexico to France.
But I'm hearing now, we just heard from our guests, that they said roughly 10% had legal representation.
Yeah.
When we were hearing from the Obama administration that X amount of attorneys were being sent down there and federal mm-hmm. attorneys and judges and everybody's being sent down there, everybody's getting a fair shake.
Well, that sounds
everybody's
like most
getting
of them
taken care of.
Lawyers are being sent down there to deport for the most part.
Okay, well, yeah. That they would have their own representation. They would mm-hmm. actually represent these kids that are coming across. Now we hear a three-year-old doesn't have an attorney. Yeah. And stands before a judge. Once again, though, heartbreaking, heart-wrenching. You feel for the kid. And that's yeah. terrible. It's awful. But it's he crossed yeah. crossed a river illegally.
Well, I tend to believe the guys that were here. That
no,
were
I
down
believe
there.
Them. I didn't say it was no. I didn't say it yeah. was wrong. But we yeah. were being told by the administration, yeah. it's all good. Everybody's got an attorney. Yeah. We sent a bunch of them down there. I fixed them myself. That's how it worked. And it didn't work that way.
Yep. Finite resources, and how are you going to allocate them? And there's not a whole lot of political support, I'm sure, for providing lawyers for.
But the sad part about it is we had no follow-up. I want to see follow-up. What happened? Give me the numbers. Love to see the stats. How many stayed? How many went? Remember the facility down south here in Arizona
yeah.
that one day it was packed?
Right.
They didn't even have a bed. Next day, gone, done. There's no one there anymore. Yeah. Where'd those kids go? I would love no one.
Those
still
are, those
no
are fair
one
questions.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of them went to family members and a lot of them got deported. And I don't know the proportions.
I would
sure
love
like,
to find
like
out.
To
right.
That.
Right.
Yep.
And then we went
yep.
to and then we shifted gears a bit and went to the prisons here. And I don't think there's a prisoner in Arizona or in the country, probably the world, that loves the facility that they're in.
No, they're not supposed okay. to be. They're not supposed to be fun.
Okay, exactly. Thank you. So when we talk about the use of solitary confinement, this is what we highlighted for a while here, the use of solitary confinement, I have a hard time going against that. And let me tell you why. Mm-hmm. My uncle was a deputy warden. I've never been a warden of a prison. I've never been a security guard in a prison. I've never done clerical work in a prison. Never been there. When you say, well, it's just easy to throw them in solitary confinement, I would say, and I would hope, that in those cases, that's their only option, not just the easiest option.
Well, you know, it's the quick. I mean, you have a behavioral problem.
Correct.
And somebody's acting out, getting violent, you restrain them, you know, and the ultimate restraint is to be in a little box.
Yep.
Where there's four walls and
like veal.
You're there by yourself. You know, I wonder if at some point there's a constitutional provision against cruel and unusual punishment. It extended solitary confinement. I think a rational person would be driven nuts. And you know,
with prolonged exposure, yeah absolutely.
Yeah, you know, and yeah, 24 hours, tough luck. You know, but yeah. months on end, that's another matter. And you know, I wonder I think the real thing is in a prison, it's relatively uncontrolled. Is it being used routinely just because it's easy? You know, obviously there are people
that, sure.
who are danger to themselves or others, and they have to be restrained to preclude that. Period.
Agreed.
Know? And the question is, what is it that does? One of the interesting comments he made about the absence of light. I will tell you about a tour I took some years ago to Tent City and Sheriff Joe's facility. Now that's jail. You're not going to spend more than a year there, but. You know, the tents were touted as this is how we're getting tough on people. You know the funny story about that is the tents are the privilege area. You work your way up to that.
I did not know that.
And I'll tell you, I absolutely understand that. You walk into the main room. You're not in a cell with two guys. You're in this
block, you know, cinder block wall thing with 300 people.
Sure.
No privacy, no light. You do not see, you know, cinder block wall, no windows, whatever. You're out in the tents. You get to see the sky. And if you've never seen that, that is important.
When you talk about it, look, it's no vacation, okay? Yeah. It's not Club Med. Yeah. A friend of mine, I say that literally, it was a friend of mine, was in Tent City. He was in Tent City for 3 months.
Yep.
He said it was like being in basic. He said like being back in the Marines.
It's a lot
he goes,
like
it
that.
He wasn't getting tough on anybody.
I mean, depends on the time of year, too, I think. You know, this time of year, not too bad. A month from now, 110 degrees.
Outside.
110 degrees, you know, that's not pleasant. But I think how bad the tents are depends an awful lot. And they do have some heaters in the winter. They do not have air conditioning in the summer. So there's trade-offs, and some months are worse than others.
But it comes back to it. It comes back to the general question. I think the one question with regards to our prison system and our detention system in this country, what is it for? That has to be answered. And if you line up 100 different people, you're going to get 100 different answers.
Criminologists will tell you there's four reasons, one of which is punishment, deterrence, specific deterrence. In other words, you're not going to commit a crime against
somebody. Not really working.
I mean, you're incapacitated against committing crimes against people who are outside when you're in.
Yeah.
Now you can commit crimes against other people there. And rehabilitation. And the last one we've kind of given up on. For the most part.
Rehabilitation, if you want to rehabilitate people, so then you have to ask the follow-up question. The follow-up question is very basic. If you're not going to rehabilitate these people, what are your options? Either keep them locked up for life, you set them back into society with the
That's the argument for rehabilitation, except for the people that are going to be there for the rest of their natural life.
Or you just kill them. What are you going to do?
If they're going to get out sometime, we as a society would like that they come out better than they went in.
And that's not happening. So once
Because that's harder to do. It's easy to punish. It's rehabilitation. You get into there are people who have drug problems who aren't motivated. It's not easy.
And now we're dealing with private prisons. Now there's money in it.
Profit motive. And that makes it a lot harder too.
Yeah, keep them in there. And I think it's great. Can you talk about what the guys are doing? The articles in the Republic.
Yeah, they're going to do a session where they tell stories like this. Phoenix Theater, 7 o'clock reception at 6. Phoenix Little Theater. Unfortunately, this event is so good they're already sold out. They're taking a wait list.
They're going to do another one. Yeah. I tell you, they're going to do another one. Hey, on behalf of Doc O'Neill, I'm Mike Russell. It's been the Think Tank. Thanks for joining us.